Maybe as a starter, something I received in the mail. It says, deep Zen-like meditation at the push of a button. Free demo cassette. Meditate like a Zen monk at the push of a button. Remarkable technology transports you effortlessly and safely into brainwave states of deep meditation. Guaranteed. Anyway, it's quick. Creates happiness, inner peace, profound permanent changes at the deepest level. Over 20,000 extremely satisfied users in 58 countries. We guarantee, anyway, on and on. If you want to take a look at it, the 800 numbers here. You know, when our mothership, which is IMS, it's up in Barre, Massachusetts, opened early on, it said that they got one of their letters was addressed to the Instant Meditation Society. So tonight what I'd like to do is we're going to be talking about the most key and deep elements of this attentional training that we do here. And I just wanted to note that tonight, I don't know if others of you sense this, but tonight was one of the most collected and still as a kind of group that I've ever experienced us here. It was really something. There was really a settling that was just very beautiful. And that doesn't mean that individually you might have felt like you were bouncing off the walls. That's okay. There was some general kind of that was really quite something. So a story that I shared last year, I'd like to, connect with it, it's a real reminder. In the north of India lived a Buddhist monk. He was known as a brother of mercy. He was a healer and a teacher who could breathe with people and really touch and open their hearts in ways that allowed them to be able to hold their own sorrows and heal. And he did it for years, but after many decades he found he was kind of depleted. He was exhausted, he was dispirited. And he heard about a great healer and teacher who lived hundreds of miles in the south, an older woman whose reputation had spread far and wide. And she was a Buddhist nun, and she had a very deep meditation practice. And she was known for her style of having people look deeply into their experience, inquire, and have profound insights as to the nature of reality. Very engaged practice that helped them discover the power of their heart and awareness. So he felt a need for her clarity and her wisdom and committed himself. He vowed to walk barefoot across the country and meet with her. He walked halfway. One night, so a week into his journey, he found shelter in a temple where pilgrims stay. And there he encountered an old nun. He told her his story, how he had spent years of his life trying to help, really holding a space and openness for people, but lost some inspiration. And sympathetic with the situation, the old woman offered to guide him to the residence of the great healer. They arrive at the edge of a bustling village and are warmly received. And as it turns out, the old nun had been none other than the much-loved healer he had been seeking. He stayed there, and over the years she taught him how to kind of set limits and how to empower others by teaching them to really look deeply into their own experience. Many years later, as she lay dying, the old nun beckoned the monk to her side. "There's something I never told you. On that day we met, I too had lost heart. I was headed north, seeking a great healer I had heard about." Then she smiled and squeezed his hand and passed away peacefully. So how might we understand this? In the end, they each needed the quality of heart-mind that the other had really developed so beautifully. That they each needed what the monk had really cultivated, that openness And openness and love become the same thing, that openness that really has this kind of tender space for whatever people are going through. And they each needed what the nun had, which is this clarity, this kind of attention that looks deeply, that notices what's happening. These are the components of our practice that we often describe as these two wings. Many of you have heard this. I think it's such a wonderful description, two wings that allow us to fly and be free. And they're inextricable. In other words, as we wake up, we need to look deeply and notice what is happening right here. That's that mindfulness, what's happening. And we need that quality of openness that makes space for what's happening, that has a quality of gentleness and tenderness. So this is, we're going to just reflect together on these qualities. It'll be a kind of a simple evening. And then what I'd like to do is have some time if any of you have questions about your practice and how this works for you. But maybe just to pause right here and let's just sense these two wings, okay? Let's just take a moment. Just let your attention go inward. And as you do, as we pause, just listen to the words of the sixth Zen patriarch. This is from what's called the Platform Sutra. Good friends, my teaching of the Dharma takes awareness and kindness as its basis. Never mistakenly say that awareness and kindness are different. They are a unity, not two things. Awareness itself is the substance of kindness. Kindness itself is the function of awareness. At the very moment there's awareness, real awareness, open awareness, then kindness exists. Just letting your attention go inward, and you might mentally whisper here. And then listen and feel with your whole awareness. As the nun taught so well, to look deeply into what's happening. What is happening this moment? What's this like being here? Sensations, sounds. And as the monk taught so beautifully, offering open, tender presence to whatever's here, saying yes, unconditionally saying yes to whatever you're experiencing, total allowing. Senses awake, noticing what's happening. In complete allowing, no resistance. These are the wings of presence. So we'll explore how we cultivate these two wings, how they come together. And usually the exploration begins by noticing how we leave presence. understanding, and this is in both Western psychology and Buddhist psychology, that it's part of our evolutionary design to perceive separateness, to out of that perception of perceiving a separate self, to get caught in kind of chasing after pleasure and tightening against pain, and in that chasing and tightening, leaving here-ness, leaving presence. And the Buddha basically described this perception as a mistake, that we mistake this vastness of being for a kind of self with a body and an agenda. And it doesn't mean that developmentally we're not supposed to experience that identity. All that it means is that there's suffering if we don't also remember the vastness of our being. In other words, we're supposed to develop an ego, we're supposed to go after things that are pleasant, we're supposed to avoid pain, and it's our innate capacity to also recognize the ocean, that we identify with waves, but also sense this vastness. And when we forget, when our whole life is organized around selfness, I want this, I'm afraid of that, it's not like that's bad. It's just that suffering. We've shrunken. Our sense of being has shrunken. Our capacity to be intimate gets cut off. Our capacity to enjoy shuts down. We've forgotten the source. There's a lovely story that several years ago came my way. A woman had a young son, and she was pregnant, about to have her second child. And before going to the hospital to deliver the second child, the young son asked if, when they came back, he could spend a few minutes with the new infant after the birth, just by himself. And she thought it was a little strange, but she said yes. Dad said yes. So she went off to the hospital, had her baby, took the baby home. And then about a week later, the son reminded her of his request. And they said, okay, go ahead. And so he went into the room. And they left the door open a crack because they were curious. They wanted to hear what was going to happen. So the boy went to the cradle. And what he said to the newborn was, please tell me about God. I've begun to forget. Forgetting and remembering, it's one of the most beautiful descriptions of spiritual life. We just forget. You know, we forget and then we remember. There are times when we kind of slow down and we remember what we cherish, and we remember the mystery of the galaxies, and we remember the mystery of love, and that's what matters. But we forget and we get caught up. So the basic perennial wisdom teachings, whether it's Buddhism or mystical Christianity or Judaism or Sufis, Islamic teachings, whatever it is, there's a kind of, at the root, there's a sense of practices that help us come home to that sense of the sacred and the divine and that vastness. And in Buddhism in particular, there's a real attention to, can we notice how we leave? I mean, really, can we make this relevant so that we wake up tomorrow morning and we start reading the newspaper or having breakfast or get to work and start a conversation with a colleague, and there's part of it, this part of us that's noticing, well, how am I leaving presence? There's a little more awareness, because if we're aware of it, we have some choice about being here. And so in these last few weeks, I've been describing some of the key elements of how we each leave. And one of the big ones I've been emphasizing is speed. We start speeding up. And I'm interested in knowing how many of you notice the relationship between speediness and kind of disconnecting from presence. How many of you notice that? That's really in your awareness. Yeah, okay. I sent a story of a policeman was running some radar for speeders. And he had a perfect spot to watch, but he wasn't getting any. And then he discovered the problem. There was a 12-year-old boy standing up the road with a hand-painted sign which read, "Radar trap ahead." And then the officer found that this young boy had a young accomplice down the road the other way with the sign reading, "Tips," and a bucket full of money. True story. Anyway, so kids are on to the speeding thing. There's another story. This motorist who was mailed a picture of his car speeding through an automated radar post, and a $40 speeding ticket was included. So, being cute, he sent the police department a picture of $40, and then the police responded with another mailed photo, a picture of handcuffs. So it's in the culture. We know it. We know the feeling of when, you know, the feeling of when you're trying to get somewhere and someone's going too slow. They're actually going the speed limit, but they're going too slow. It's that. That's one of the flags, and I'm being playful about it, but speed is one of the flags of speeding away from some angst, some unease that's right here. The other way we leave, and that we do habitually, is in judgment. If you just, for the next month, said, every time I catch myself judging, I'm going to pause, you would be using what I call a Dharma doorway. You'd be pausing and finding out underneath this habit to say, you're wrong, you're bad, you're letting me down, there is again this we're leaving some basic angst or unease or woundedness that we're not staying at home and doing the healing that really can free us. The other flag of leaving home, and again, these are the ways that we end up cutting off from presence, is lost in thought, the mental proliferation. And Thomas Merton, who I love Thomas Merton, a lot of his writings and poetry and so on, really described this busyness and this mental figuring out and worrying and planning and scheming as violence. He says, it violates our natural rhythms. It pulls us away from that kind of attention to what's right here, what's always been here, and as what is sacred. So we violate ourselves, and we also violate others because we're not there. I heard, I was listening to, some tape or something a couple of years ago, and a woman was describing how her 4-year-old daughter got a paint set, and she had this magical discovery of how when you put together yellow and blue, what happens. And she was so excited through the day, and the mom said, well, you got to show your dad tonight when he comes home. And so she was just really, the little girl was just waiting and waiting, and the dad, a stockbroker, got home very, very late, and he walks in the house on his cell phone, and she's trailing around him, and then this little girl's trying to say, Daddy, Daddy, and he's all occupied, and then he gets on the landline. I mean, this is like he's closing a big deal, and she's tugging on his trousers, and finally he says, a little irritated, Melissa, what are you doing down there? And she responded, I live down here, Daddy. There's a very real disconnecting from the life of the beings around us when we speed up, when we create the separation of blame. And blaming, I'm not talking about just, big, huge unforgiveness. I'm talking about just the little blames that we do through the day of the people close to us that creates an armoring of the heart. There's speeding, there's blaming, and then this busyness, this figuring, this preoccupation. We're occupied. So this is when we begin to sense in our life how this, what I sometimes call selfing, this occupation with self and speeding to get what the self wants and judging and that other is wrong. When we start getting the suffering of it, we become very motivated to come home. when we get that we're cut off. We're cut off from the only place that can really be loving and aware. We want to come home. And like the monk and the nun, we each have an intuition of a kind of a wholeness of being, each of us. We each have an intuition about loving and not holding back, and about moving through our day wakefully, like really awake, like noticing what's happening. A sense of the wholeness that's possible. And we each have a yearning. We wouldn't be here. I ask you each week, what's your intention? And someday it would be nice just, and we do this in our retreats sometimes, just to hear different people use their language. But the energy of our intention is, through all the different languaging, that we each want to know who we really are. We really want to come home to the fullness and live from that love and live from that presence. You are really in search of yourself without knowing it. This is Sri Narsargadatta. You are love, longing for the love worthy, the perfectly lovable. Due to ignorance, you're looking for it in the world of opposites and contradictions. When you find it within, your search will be over. When you find it in the awareness that's already here, your search will be over. So we begin this kind of practice of, okay, waking up these two wings, of noticing what's here and opening our hearts to it. And the practice is fueled by our attitude. In other words, if you sit down to meditate and it's doing it out of duty, if you sit down and it's doing it out of obligation, if you sit down out of habit, then what'll happen is you might quiet your mind a little, or you might not, and you might achieve a certain state, or you might not. But there's not a homecoming. Because a homecoming arises when we long to come home. It's the longing that carries us, the sincerity. Does that make sense? The quality of the heart that we bring to practice is really what carries us home. The techniques come and go. You don't have to be good at meditating. In fact, that's one of the big problems and mistakes we make, is we have this idea, well, a good meditator quiets their mind and knows how to sit very still and then achieve certain states that are like this, you know, peaceful, open, this, that. Stuff just happens. We have different weather going through. You don't have to be a good meditator. But what really will carry you home is that you care about discovering who you are and what you are. That you care about living from love and presence. And that care, it'll find its way home. So that's the beginning of this cultivating these wings of noticing and allowing. So let's look at the two wings and then we'll just practice a little and see if you have questions. The first wing, mindfulness. This is the noticing wing, the nun, the what's happening. So in mindfulness is that which is really listening and noticing sound. Mindfulness is noticing the sensations in your body right now. Is there mindfulness? Mindfulness is noticing whatever feelings are here. See, it's a noticing. What obscures the noticing? Maybe you're sitting here meditating and you go off in thoughts. And you hear me say, if you've been lost in thoughts, come on back. Let's just feel what's here. But instead of coming back, you go, I always get lost in thoughts. You know, everybody else is meditating, but all I've been doing is planning work tomorrow and what I'm going to wear, what I'm going to present, or what I'm going to have for dinner. So there's this proliferation. That's what obscures mindfulness. The judgment. Something's wrong. Or maybe during the day you get into an argument with somebody, and mindfulness would be to sense, okay, there's a story of this person wronged me. But mindfulness is to notice that and then notice how it feels in your body. Notice the fear or the hurt. What interferes? We get re-looped into the stories of wrongness. We forget to be here. So the deepening of practice is to begin to notice without any judgment at all, just to observe what's happening. Clean. One of the stories that I've shared here before that I think is a great example comes from the film Gorillas in the Mists. Diane Fossey is shown in that to be this field biologist who manages to befriend a tribe of gorillas. So she's following in the footsteps of George Shaler, who many of you have heard of, the biologist. He is renowned for having gone into the wilds and returned with more intimate and compelling info about gorilla life than anybody ever had been able to discover before. And when his colleagues asked how he was able to learn so much about their tribal structure and their family life and their intimate habits, he attributed all to one thing. He didn't carry a gun. Now just let's slow down here. He didn't carry a gun. That's what gave him insight into what was actually happening. That in previous generations of observers had entered the territory of these large wild gorillas with the assumption they were fearsome and dangerous. So they came with a kind of aggression or a protective spirit. And they had these rifle-toting men, and the gorillas kept a distance. But by contrast, Shaler enters the territory without a weapon. And he moves slowly and gently, and above all, respectfully towards these creatures. And seeing their benevolence, they allowed him to really be there. It's the same way with our inner life. If we can let the fear or the shame or the guilt or the jealousy or the excitement or the lust or the whatever it is play out, and rather than carrying a gun, rather than judging it, oh, this shouldn't be here, or oh my God, what does this mean, or will this ever go away, just respectful. Okay, this. Now it's this. That is the beginning of profound mindfulness. So one element, if you want to begin to deepen your practice, the question is, what is happening inside me? To be committed, not to judge it. Instead, to slow down. Be interested. Just like a scientist, be interested. Here's a poem for you. To look at anything, if you would know that thing, you must look at it long. To look at this green and say, I have seen spring in these woods, will not do. You must be the thing you see. You must be the dark snakes of stems and furry plumes of leaves. You must enter into the small silences between the leaves. You must take your time and touch the very peace they issue from. You must take your time and touch the very peace they issue from. To look at anything, if you would know that thing, you must look at it long. It doesn't go with our culture, but it goes with any path that is wanting intimacy. You can't be intimate with another being unless you slow down and really look and sense behind the words, who's there? You can't be intimate with your inner life unless you slow down. Let go of the judgments. and just see what's here. Now, a question that comes up about mindfulness and that came up on a workshop I led Saturday is, but this looking and noticing, you know, this idea of being mindful every moment, that's the opposite of what I need. I'm over-vigilant anyway. I need to relax, you know. It's that thing. It's like the idea of, okay, now I'm noticing this, now I'm noticing now this breath, now that kind of thing. So I just wanted to address that a little in case that's a question some of you have about mindfulness. Because I'm not speaking of this wing of mindfulness as something we just do on the cushion in a formal way. We're talking about a quality of wakefulness that we really bring alive through our lives. It doesn't have to be what I call microscopic. There are times when you might feel a great wave of sadness or loneliness or fear and get very microscopic, say, okay, I'm going to stay and really feel what this is like and breathe with it and really sense how it moves and changes and so on. And that's very appropriate. But at other times, you might be with your child and they're telling you about what happened during the day or whatever. And then you have not a microscopic lens of mindfulness, but maybe a midway lens where you're aware of being present, you're aware of listening, you're aware of the look in your child's eyes, of their mood or what matters to them. And you might even be aware of what possibly might be burning on the stove at that time. That's the kind of, you know what I mean? But there's like an awareness. It's a little more comprehensive. It's mindful, but it's not narrow. And then there's times it's very wide where you're walking in the woods and it's the wide-angle lens, the sounds and sensations. So there's birds and there's the breeze and the feelings of stepping on the earth and the smells. And maybe some thoughts. And you just, it's a wider lens. And then there's the mindfulness of awareness itself, where there's this presence, this listening. And then there's the what's happening is who's listening right now. So mindfulness turns back and looks into awareness. Who is listening? Who's aware? So I'm bringing that up because different moments will call forth a different quality, our lens of mindfulness. But the common denominator is that there is a wakefulness, not a strain, not tight, but noticing what's happening. Now, the challenge often is that what's happening is difficult to have room for. That we say what's happening and then what we notice is there's angst, there's fear, there's something really uncomfortable. In the Buddhist time, he'd send his monks into the jungles to practice mindfulness. And he sent them into a particular jungle that was known to be inhabited by ghosts and demons and spirits and so on. Scary ones. And they'd all come back and totally freaked out and say, we can't meditate there. There's no way in the world. And in this culture in Asia, a lot of fear of ghosts in particular. It was then that he taught the metta, or loving kindness practice, which is a practice of openness and care. It's a practice that engenders connection. Now, there's a beautiful understanding that our fear is great, but greater yet is the truth of our connectedness. If we can remember love, if we can remember longing, then we can deal with the waves of fear. Okay? So he taught them the loving kindness practice as a way to help them remember or reconnect with that field of belonging. The metta practice, that sense of connection, starts with befriending the life within us. If we're tender towards the life within us, there's going to be space for what's difficult. So here's why it can't be just the nun's way of clear seeing and wisdom. We need that space, okay? So in the metta practice, we begin to notice and appreciate really the goodness that's right within our own being. We usually fixate on what's wrong. So this is a key training if we want to wake up these two wings of awareness, to begin to really appreciate right now here. Okay, so what is it that you can really say that you honor in yourself? Is it that you care about waking up? That you care about honesty? That you care about caring even though you sometimes shut down? Your humor? That you love beauty? I mean, can we begin to remember what we appreciate? Galway Connell says, "The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing, though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness." To reteach a thing its loveliness. To put a hand on the brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch, "It is lovely," until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. Reteach a thing its loveliness. So this is the wing of openness and love, that we begin to remember our goodness, because that creates the space, the openness, so that when something arises, there's room for it, that we can actually be with our experience. And when we begin to be with our own experience with a quality of tenderness and appreciation, that's how we respond to our world. There's openness. And it might be that there's different flavors of that openness, so that if we see the shine in a child's eye or their laughter, which when they're entertained, there's a sense of loving kindness. But if we see a friend who's brokenhearted at a big loss, the flavor of that open love is compassion. And if we see the beauty of the cherry blossoms with the snow on them, then there's that, the love which is the wonder. So we cultivate this wing of openness. And what happens is that when we practice regularly, it's like whatever you pay attention to, that becomes your habit of being. And if you pay attention to goodness and wake up the love, that becomes the habit of response. A friend of mine from the West Coast, Sylvia Borstein, who some of you might know, told a story that I wanted to share with you. She had a good friend, a famous doctor who for years had served as the president of the American Psychiatric Association. And he was known as a gentleman, a man of integrity and kindness, who brought great joy to everything in his life. He was filled with metta. That was his habit, loving kindness. He had always offered a deep respect to his patients and colleagues. And after he retired and grew older, he started to become senile. He lost his memory and his ability to recognize people. He still lived at home and his wife helped take care of him. Being longtime friends, Sylvia and her husband Seymour were invited to his home for dinner one evening. It had been some time since they had last seen him, and they wondered if his senility had increased. They arrived at the door with a bottle of wine and rang the doorbell. He opened the door and looked at them with a kind of blank stare that showed no recognition of who they were, even though they had been friends for many years. Then he smiled and said, "I don't know who you are, but whoever you are, please come in and enjoy my home." And he offered them the same graciousness with which he had lived for his whole life. The karmic patterns we develop right here, in other words, we can't change the past, but what we develop here, how we pay attention this moment, creates our future. And if this moment, instead of judging or blame, we come and just be with the vulnerability that's here and opening compassion, or in this moment we bring to mind somebody that is important to us and take some moments to reflect on their goodness and feel our appreciation, not abstract, but our heart's appreciation. maybe in this moment resolve that we're going to let someone know that we love them, that we haven't said out loud, because every one of us forgets and needs to know that. This moment, then, we've planted the seed of loving kindness, so that when whatever happens, our bodies, our minds, there is a kind of quality of connectedness to heart that is timeless, that we've reconnected to. We've come home. That's why the Dalai Lama, when he speaks, so often says, "My religion is kindness." We can't separate awareness from kindness. So we develop these two wings, noticing, and this wing of heart, of openness, that lets us really be fully with what we notice. And we develop them, and then discover their gifts. And really what we discover is that everything that we long for, if we're really noticing what's happening and open, we discover it here. This is what I spoke of last week. Isn't it true that the peace you long for isn't already here? Isn't it true? It might not seem true if we're speedy, judging, and preoccupied, right? But what happens when we really start saying, well, what is happening? And then we bring this deep yes to whatever it is, a deep, deep openness. Isn't it already here? It's a story of a shoemaker named Kabir who worked, and when he worked, he always repeated the mantra, Ram, Ram, Ram. That's the word of God or the sacred, divine. Day in and day out, 20 years, Ram, Ram, Ram. He repeated and he was happy and just, it was just, he loved it. And so then finally, after 20 years, Ram appears. And so Kabir says, "Who are you?" And Ram says, "Well, I'm Ram." And Kabir says, "Well, why are you here?" And then Ram kind of, "Why am I here? You've been calling me for years. Now I've come. What do you want?" So Kabir says, "I don't want anything." And then Ram says, "What? Well, why have you been repeating my name?" And Kabir said, "I just love repeating your name." And so then for the years to come, wherever Kabir would go, he'd be followed by Ram and the sound, Kabir, Kabir, Kabir. So I love it because isn't it true? It's like what we long for is already here. And we're just coming home to what's here. And in the deepest way, what we're coming home to and what we long for is who we already are. We long for the awareness and love that is our essence. Alice Walker has a new book, and there's a quote, the title is from a very old saying, "We are the ones we've been waiting for." We are the ones we've been waiting for. This is the gift of the two wings. It takes us home to the fullness of who we are. So why don't you just close your eyes for a moment. Very gently pausing. Very gently, just noticing, what's it like right now? To really allow what's here, just unconditionally saying yes to this life right here. notice and allow, and to sense who's aware of all this, to sense the mysterious presence. The awareness that's the source of being. Luminous, open, tender. We are the ones we've been waiting for. So we have a few minutes if anyone has a question about the practice or anything that we've been talking about. And then I will again next week even create more time, because for all I say about quieting and silencing, I yapped away longer than I meant to. So any questions tonight? Yeah, please. Yeah. The question is, I was talking about judgment and how judgment creates separation and suffering. And then what Betsy asked is, but doesn't the very word suffering have judgment to it? And I think it's a wonderful question. Suffering, if we think of it like it shouldn't happen or it's bad, yeah. If we look at suffering, the Pali word in suffering, dukkha, means uneasiness. It's really like saying it's just an aspect of being alive, that there's a certain stress that's inherent in existence. And it's not bad, but the deal is that we have the capacity to wake up in a way that we're not trapped in it. So it's like saying it's not bad that the flower is a bud, is, you know, small and not fully developed, but there's a possibility of awakening beyond it. But it's very easy to get trapped in this notion that something's wrong with us because we're suffering. So I really like that you're bringing it up. I think we very quickly, this is the proliferation of suffering. We're having a hard time, then we think we're unspiritual or something's wrong that we're having a hard time. So that brings a light, shines kind of a light on that. So thank you. Yeah, please. So this is, we had a day long on addiction, and the question is really, how do we begin to wake up out of addictive behavior? And it's too big a question for me to, we did a whole day long on it, and that was just like, you know, just a sliver. But I'll say one thing about addiction, which is that I've begun to think of it, instead of calling it as addictioning, which is that we have patterns that are kind of like a chain of reactivity that all of us get caught in, where we go from wanting something to grasping, to then not liking ourselves for that, to then doing it more. And that there's cycles that we all get in that are, so that addiction, rather than a noun, it's a verb. And that a key thing in freeing ourselves from this addictioning is to open out of the idea of an addict, that I am an addict, that I am the attached person or I'm the dependent person, and seeing just this verb, this chain of reaction, and then sensing yourself as the awareness, as a compassionate awareness that's aware of the addictioning, but not in the self-concept of the addict. And so in a bigger way, what I'm saying is that enlightenment is waking up out of our small self story. It doesn't mean we don't use the ego to move, to navigate, but it's recognizing a vastness, recognizing something larger. And it's a trap to be identified as an addict. It doesn't mean that we're irresponsible or don't acknowledge the suffering that comes from behaviors, but that who you are is bigger than that. So So I hope that says it some. Yeah.
How does one stay present to not being present to distraction and find yourself constantly in control of
the question is, when you're just chronically distracted, how do you remember? And so, and then you said, is there something in the not being present that reminds you? And that's partly it. There's suffering. Not that it's bad, but it's painful. There's suffering in not presence. And the suffering is then we get alienated. We don't feel close with others. And we don't feel a sense of contentment or enjoyment in the moment. So that suffering is often the wake-up call that says, pause, breathe, deepen your practice, come home. So that's one way, is that the suffering reminds us. Another way is you wouldn't be asking that question unless you cared about presence. And it's the who you really are that's caring. So the practice of aspiration, you know how every night here we start by saying what matters, what do you care about? Getting in touch sincerely, like in a real alive way, with it matters to be present. And if all you do, and this is a great practice in Tibet, they describe the beginning and ending practices, at the beginning of a day, with whatever sitting you do, just come into your heart and say what matters to you for the day. May I move through this day with presence. May I let myself, when I see someone, see who they are. Whatever your wish is, make it. And at the end of the day, just sense how the day went and see if without any judgment you can just notice, oh, okay, got really lost for about 8 hours there, but then there was a moment of whatever it is, you know. But there's a way in which you start becoming more awake to the landscape of your day and how much presence is in it. So those are the two ways. The suffering will wake you up and the formal practice of aspiration. You might, during the week, if you have questions like this about the whole path, about your practice, think of them, and I will create a little more time next week for this because I really value hearing what you're wondering about and having that kind of an exchange. Thank you.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington, to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.